Today I'm going to talk to you about how to get fermions and gauge fields from very simple quantum spin systems. And this is a very interesting game which is being played, and lots of very exciting progress is going on. So this is Phil Anderson, who is responsible for beginning this field way back in 1973. And then with this discovery of superconductivity in cuprates, this field began again, and lots of exciting things are going on. So this is a photograph that I took of young Anderson last year. Phil will be entering 90 years this December. So he continues to go strong. So these are all collaborators over time with whom I had the pleasure of working on spin liquid physics. So this is what I plan to do. So I will, after some introduction, talk about quantum fluctuations in antiferromagnets, and then talk about RVB states and how, in a very simple approximate analysis, things like fermions and gauge fields emerged. Then in the last 7-8 years, there has been a lot of excitement about use of quasi-particles of resonating valence bond-like systems in quantum computing. In that context, Kitaev, the originator of this idea of topological quantum computation, solved a delightful model, which is called Kitaev honeycomb model, where all our dreams, all our approximations came true. So it's a very nice, exactly solvable model, where you start with spins, and then you get Majorana fermions, and also you get Z2 gauge fields. So I will briefly discuss that. Then come to the issue here about whether the emergent gauge fields can condense in the ground state, can have non-zero expectation value, so it will be a kind of symmetry breaking. So I will discuss the physics of that. And then in the last few years, some model that was studied long ago has come back to prominence. A lot of work is going on. This is to establish presence of spin liquids in some simple two-dimensional model. Because fortunately, there are also some experimental indications that it is indeed true. So this is what I plan to do. So if I want to summarize the whole talk, it's this. That is, I have a spin Hamiltonian where spins have some short-range interactions. So particularly, I focus on spin half. That is, so it's half of Pauli spin operators. And then can one see in the physics of this problem something like fermions moving on a lattice connected to some gauge fields? So this is the question. And the answer is that at some energy scale, it is possible to achieve this. So before I begin with this theoretical aspects, I have to give a brief introduction for the sake of students about Martin insulators. They are the seeds of this novel quantum state, namely quantum spin liquid. So it's good to think about a thought experiment that Mott suggested several years ago. So imagine you have a simple cubic lattice made up of hydrogen atoms. So each hydrogen atom has one electron. So when the lattice parameter is comparable to Bohr radius of the same size, let us say, then the 1s wave functions of hydrogen atom will overlap, and you will form a band made of primarily 1s atomic orbital. And there are n such plane wave states, block states, in that band. And each state can accommodate 2 electrons. So you will get a half-filled band. So this is a metal. This is a well-known. For example, if you want to talk about sodium or any monovalent metal, this is the way you go about doing it. The simplest state bending approximation. Then Mott asks the question, suppose we expand this lattice adiabatically, make the lattice parameters much larger compared to Bohr radius, and let's think about the physics of this situation. You can think in two ways. One is from band theory point of view. If you think in terms of band theory point of view, there won't be any significant change because the band will become narrower and narrower. It will continue to be half-filled band. So one will imagine that it will continue to be a conductor or a metal. But very simple physics tells you that that cannot be true, because when the lattice parameter is very large, it's difficult to pluck out an electron from a hydrogen atom and put it elsewhere. So charges tend to be confined to individual hydrogen atoms. So this is called a Martin oscillator. So band theory fails in a very nice way. It says that I cannot work here because electrons don't like to form block states, because in order for an electron to tunnel from one hydrogen atom to another hydrogen atom, it has to overcome some Coulomb barrier. So it would rather sit at home and do some quantum fluctuation. So this is called a Martin insulator. Now this insulator is very different from an insulator like diamond or germanium, where if you think about it, it's an even electron system per unit cell. So you have a filled band. So both charge and spin degrees of freedom are inert. You need a gap, you need a finite energy to create any excitation. Whereas here you have a very interesting situation where while charges cannot move, spins are rather free. They don't know what to do. In principle, when the lattice parameter is very, very large, you have 2 to the power of n fold spin degeneracy. So you have a situation wherein there is enormous spin degeneracy, but there is no charge excitation degeneracy. So this is a Martin oscillator. Now this is where magnetism works in a very beautiful way. Suppose you start from the limit in which the lattice parameter is indeed very, very large. Then let me include hopping processes as quantum fluctuations. Because, for example, if you take two neighboring sites, an electron won't be sitting always here. There are tunneling possible, so it will undergo a virtual transition and could come back to an exchange configuration. In the process, you gain energy. You gain delocalization energy, which is minus 4 T square over U, where T is a hopping matrix element. U is the intermediate state energy. Now, here comes Pauli principle. Pauli principle says that while that process is allowed, this is blocked. Two parallel spins cannot do this virtual transition. So Pauli principle and interaction together start distinguishing singlets from triplets. So this is the beginning of magnetism in insulators. So we summarize that normally in terms of a Hamiltonian in which you work in the subspace of the spins alone and then take care of virtual transition through this J, so-called super exchange, and then this will be the Hamiltonian of my Martin oscillator of a collection of hydrogen atoms, and they are well separated. So you notice that to create a charge excitation, there is a big gap called Mott-Hubbard gap, whereas spin excitations is governed by this J. So all interesting antiferromagnetism and sometimes ferromagnetism is governed by this kind of physics. So a very natural separation of spin degree of freedom occurs from charge degree of freedom. In the sense, one becomes very massive or gapful, other is gapless. So it is in this background we will. So now, spins are quantum mechanical. They don't have a big Hilbert space. Like if you take a spin of object, there are only two states possible. So you have to work within this Hilbert space. So naturally, you expect a lot of quantum fluctuation. So let us see a few situations. Suppose you have ferromagnetic coupling. Then the life is very simple because of various good reasons. The ground state in which J is negative is all spins up. So the total spin has a maximal value. And of course, you can globally rotate it, have any projection of total SZ. They are all equal in ground state. Now, if you take such a state, it's an eigenstate. There is no quantum fluctuation. And then you can create a spin flip. Let's say, for example, you can flip one spin and then put it in a plane wave state by a superposition like this. This will be called a spin wave. Your classical picture will be some Lorentz precession about some mean field. Here, a single spin flip travels like a block wave. So the energy of this dispersion is omega q proportional to q squared. This is a famous spin wave. And people familiar with Goldstone mode will immediately wonder, why do I get a quadratic dispersion rather than linear dispersion? OK, that we can discuss it later if there is any interest. Now, physics becomes different when we consider an antiferromagnet. Now, when you have coupling which is positive, and imagine spins to be classical, then they will be very happy in an arrangement in which in spins, in sublattice A is up and sublattice B is down. So this is a very happy state. But however, spins are not classical, so they are quantum mechanical. So quantum fluctuations will have to be incorporated. At the end of the day, what happens is if you do a semi-classical so-called spin wave analysis and find out what is the ground state is this, corrected by this factor. Basically, what this factor does is it acts on the Neel state, and pairwise it flips the spins, and then does some kind of coherent superposition. So the end result is if you take this state and measure sublattice magnetization, you don't get half, but you get a reduction. Now, this reduction is a measure of zero-point fluctuation. And if you do this calculation for one-dimensional spin chain, what you find is that reduction, when you evaluate the integral within the spin wave theory, diverges as log of the size of the system. And if you do the same thing in two dimensions, there is no divergence. There is like a 30% reduction. So this is a very important fact that a nil state, even though classically is a nice state, is not an eigenstate. So you have to give some spread. So this is somewhat like a harmonic oscillator problem. So I'll use this part of the board. So if you have a double well, then if you construct a wave packet like this, it's not an eigenstate. Or if you construct a wave packet like this, not so the real eigenstate is a coherent superposition of these two. So something like this, tunnels back and forth. So for example, if you take two spins, that's what happens. This is not an eigenstate, so you have a coherent tunneling between back and forth, which is a ground state singular. So already, if you think carefully about it, the quantum fluctuations of this spin wave has a lot of structure in it. Normally, we ignore it. We worry about average value of magnetization because it could become very important, as we will see, when SZ vanishes. That is, you are left with quantum fluctuation alone. There is no long-range order. Then physics becomes very interesting, and lots of consequences are there. Now, if you go to excitations of this quantum antiferromagnet, it's not quadratic. It looks like relativity theory, and you have some kind of Goldstone mode with some spin wave velocity. Now we try to do this in another lattice, not on a square lattice, on a triangular lattice, which unfortunately cannot be separated into two sublattices. So it can be separated into three sublattices. And what you find is the spins order, they cannot, okay, this is very clear in the next transparencies. So what happens, spins have 120 degree, three sublattice pattern. Now, because of the structure, what you find is there is magnetic tension in the bonds. Not all bond energies can be minimized simultaneously in the ground state. So this is a very key point. Your lattice structure and the nature of interaction prevents individual bond energy minimization as minimizing the total energy. So this is the crux of the problem. So, for example, this is very manifest. Here, I'm talking about continuous degrees of freedom. So spins can point in any direction and minimize the energy. Suppose I have so-called Ising spins, which, because of various spin-orbit coupling and magnetocrystalline anisotropy and so on, is forced to point either up or down. Then you really have a situation in which these two spins are happy. These two spins are happy, whereas these two spins are unhappy because the coupling is antiferromagnetic, they are parallel. So for example, so there are three such degenerate configuration, and system can be in any one of the configuration. So this is called a frustrated spin system. Now, when you think about the quantum dynamics, it is convenient to separate the spin-spin coupling in the form of a kinetic energy term and potential energy term. Of course, you will argue that since I have SU2 spin rotational invariance, it is left to me how I separate it. For example, I can choose X and Z component and call as Y component as the potential energy. That means I change the quantization direction. So I can choose any convention, but I stick to one. So the entire physics of quantum spin liquid and all this interesting thing is a competition between kinetic and potential energy. You want to minimize the total energy, but each one of them want to have their share. So there is interesting competition. I'm repeating that. And in real spin systems, often there is anisotropy. For example, Z component may be larger than one or less than one. Then you are reduced, your symmetry becomes from SU2 to U1 symmetry. Or if you have this alone, that you are left with so-called Z2 Ising symmetry. Now we will, just before we proceed, we will get some feeling for what is going on by solving a three-side problem. It's a solvable model. So what we do is we take three spins forming a triangle coupled with equal antiferromagnetic coupling. And you can rewrite it as total spin square and then classify the eigenstates. And what you find is there is already rich physics here. There are totally 2 to the power of 3 or 8 states, and the ground state manifold has 4 states, 4 degenerate state, and the first and there is one excited state which is a total spin 3 half. Now the spin half state splits into 2 parts, one called chi plus 1 and chi minus 1, and each one of them is a spin half state, so a pair of spin half state. Now this is a very important operator here. This will be related to the emergent gauge fields later. What you find is this operator has changes sign when you interchange 2 and 3, for example. So it has a parity which is different, and it turns out it commutes with the Hamiltonian. So because of that, you can classify the eigenstates as corresponding with positive eigenvalues of this quantity or negative eigenvalue. In particular, here you have chi is plus 1 or chi minus 1. Here in the case chi is 0. Now what is this quantity? This actually tells you how the 3 spins quantum fluctuate in the ground state, what kind of handedness it chooses. For example, if I have 3 spins, I can have them like this with left-handed form, or like this with right-handed form. So this operator distinguishes it. So while it is quantum fluctuating, it's maintaining its handedness. In fact, it's very nice to see it when you go to spin coherent states and project it onto the spin coherent states. You can see how all these things happen in a very nice way. Now let me write it in terms of the original SZ eigenstate. Then it's very simple. What you notice here is you have 3 spins. Let's say the middle spin is down. Here the last spin is down. Here the first spin is down. So it's a coherent superposition of 3 state with e to the power of i2π/3 and the square of that. It basically means there is one down spin which is running around this triangle with angular momentum plus 1. It can run around in the opposite direction with angular momentum minus 1. So that means in this particular state, there is a current in the ground state, namely spin current. So chi 1, 2, 3 is a measure of spin current, you can also say. So this is interesting that because of the way things are interacting, there is a finite spin current in the ground state. And in order to respect the original symmetry of the Hamiltonian, namely it has parity symmetry, if you have a current with positive current, then there should be a negative current state, which is degenerate. Now in the language of singlets, it's even similar. What actually happens is you can rewrite this state as 2 spins forming a singlet and an unpaired spin. You can call it as a spin-on if you want. This spin-on is running around among this 3 site with angular momentum plus 1 or minus 1. So, yes. This one? No, they are. No, they are orthogonal. No, in this case, they are orthogonal. In this particular case. Am I right?
No, because when you
have
two reciprocal.
But finally, this is a correct statement. It may be they may be linearly dependent, but this is the correct wave function. In fact, what Ramesh Shah is pointing out is an important point. When you think about this valence bond basis, it's very clear when you take 4 sites, you can form singlets like this, then you can form singlet like this, then you can also form singlet like this. It turns out these 3 are not linearly independent. There is a relation between them, so only you can form 2 orthogonal states out of these 3. In fact, this is a problem when you work in valence bonds. As a graph, it looks orthogonal or different, but as a wave function, they won't be. So one has to take care of that. Yes.
So chi is
yes. Please repeat. You are saying that. So, if I think in terms of a particle, for example, I have 3 sides, and I imagine downspin as a particle in this 3 side, then that is running around. There is a particle which is running around.
I'm simply saying that it's not spin
current. It's not. Okay. I see. So you want to distinguish. Actually, the correct name is called topological spin current. There is some. Maybe that will resolve this. We can discuss it later. Okay, now since we are talking about quantum liquid, I just wanted to briefly tell you about liquids. Now, liquids is one of the hard problems in physics. Even though it looks very simple, calculating properties of liquid is very hard. So we have liquids, we have liquid crystals, and when you come to quantum systems, you have the famous superfluid helium-4. Or in 2D, liquid which is dominated by vortex fluctuation is called 2D vortex liquid helium-4. And then there are vortex glasses. Then when you come to electron, you have metals, Fermi liquid, and in some cases, so-called enigmatic liquid, which have some spontaneous anisotropy. Then there are superconductor. The corresponding spin will be an ordered antiferromagnet with quantum fluctuation will be called a spin crystal, like what we saw. And then similarly, you can have helium-4 solid with a lot of quantum fluctuation. And there is also something called super solid helium-4. There are some very deep analogies between them and quantum magnets with a lot of quantum fluctuation. Now, below I have written a classical paramagnet. Suppose I take an antiferromagnet and heat it to very high temperature, above the Néel temperature. Then you have basically classical spins. There is no quantum coherence. That you can call it as a classical spin gas and spin liquid. Then the kind of thing that we are talking about is a quantum spin liquid in which there is similar probability for spins with various various configuration, but there is a coherence among those components. So that's what makes it as a quantum spin liquid. Like if you take a superfluid helium-4, what makes it superfluid is that you may imagine many configurations of atoms, spatial configurations, and their permutation. All of them have identical phase relation. That's what makes it a superfluid. So in the same way, you can have a spin fluid liquid. What is interesting is spin-spin correlation function is very short-range in this, typically. So spins are not ordered, but there is some other order related to the phases of the valence bonds. So sometimes you can have valence bond solid, and similarly you can have classical spin glass or valence bond glass, chiral glass, and so on. So a variety of things are possible. Now I take this opportunity to introduce to you an elementary Mott insulator. It's a very CuO, it's called a tenorite. It's a very beautiful system. It has a structure which is monoclinic. I will not go into the structure, but the quantum chemistry is very simple. When you put copper and oxygen together, oxygen is greedy, it wants to fill up the empty shell, partially filled shell. So it grabs two electrons and copper is happy with one hole in the D shell. Now copper is not in a spherical environment anymore, in a solid. So its 3D levels are split like this, crystal field splitting. And then you are left with a lone electron in the topmost level. So if you think in terms of atomic orbital, this is the nature of the orbital, so-called dx square minus y square orbital. There is one lone electron and lone electron. Because of intervention of oxygen, these are all well separated. And these Vanier functions have smaller overlap than in metallic copper. So as a result, you satisfy Mott's criteria and you don't delocalize. Basically, electrons sit in their home site and undergo some quantum fluctuation. Now here it happens through oxygen, so that's called super exchange. Eventually, you have some antiferromagnetic coupling between these two systems. So this is a very nice elementary Mott insulator. Even now, we don't understand the quantum spin state of many of these things in detail. There are very interesting issues. So if you do a susceptibility measurement, this is what you will see. You know that if you take a ferromagnet and do susceptibility, there will be Curie divergence, and then it will come back. Whereas in the case of an antiferromagnet, you will see some kind of cusp here. So this is how you will distinguish that there is an antiferromagnetic transition. Now, it was noticed by P.W. Anderson in the early 70s that many of these oxides that he was looking at, particularly spin off oxides, never showed this cusp. It was rather smoothened out. So indicating somehow long-range antiferromagnetic order in many oxides are not liked. There are lots of quantum fluctuation, either due to geometrical frustration, like in a triangular lattice, or due to lower dimensionality. So somehow it would like to avoid long-range order and remain in some kind of quantum spin liquid state. That was the beginning. So now there are new systems by Kanoda and their group. Here you have a very complex organic molecule denoted by this symbol. So basically what you have two organic molecules. The size will be like 10 angstrom in it. and there is one electron spread over here, and those orbitals weakly overlap. So there is one electron per circle here, and they undergo super exchange, and then they form a very nice triangular lattice. Now, if you take that Mott insulator, and then wonderful things happen. To begin with, there is no long range magnetic order. Then you keep applying pressure, then there is a Mott transition, self doping, and then you get a superconductor and you get many anomalous features, which is very much like what you see in cuprates. So it's an organic analog of cuprate superconductivity with this spin liquid physics. So this is very widely investigated in the recent time. Like if you follow the susceptibility, what you find is you would have expected a cusp somewhere in this region. You don't expect any cusp. You don't find any phase transition. Susceptibility goes very smoothly, and that is excitement. That means somehow the spins accept quantum fluctuations, and they are this quantum disordered, and what can happen? Okay. So now there are many proposals for quantum spin liquids. In fact, in Michel Gingras and the company, they do a lot of these things in quantum 3D pyrochlores and so on. Now, the idea of spin liquid actually had a very different beginning from Pauling. Pauling wanted to understand benzene and so-called P pi bonded system like graphene. He said that forget about band theory, and you can understand most of physics of graphene using this idea, in which if you take carbon atom, there are these four valence electrons. Three of them get lost in sigma bonding, for example, here. And then you are left with one electron in the pz orbital, which is this orbital. And they undergo singlet or valence bond formation. So for example, this double bond will mean that an electron here and an electron form a singlet. So Pauling said that there are many ways of forming a singlet. So the right way to think about a ground state is a coherent superposition. In the process, Pauling suppressed so-called polar configuration, in which this will be doubly occupied or this will be empty. So in fact, Pauling, much before Mott, was describing actually a Mott state, what we will call as a Mott state. So he did not, in fact, apparently later, even after band theory became famous and Fermi surfaces were seen, Pauling said that you can discuss most of metal physics using this kind of idea. So it is then P.W. Anderson reacted by saying that for metal physics, you'll have to use Fermi surface and band theory. But for Mott insulator, your description will be correct. In fact, this was Anderson's criticism on Pauling's theory, which started the whole game. So this started in 1973. So what Anderson said was, suppose you take a square lattice, he took a triangular lattice. Under some condition, this may not be the ground state. The ground state will be the one in which electrons are happy locally because they form a singlet with the least energy. And in the process, these two electrons are not happy. But however, I make the whole everybody happy by giving them an opportunity to form a singlet also. So there is a quantum resonance which reduces energy. So the issue was, is it possible to have this kind of ground state in some real systems or even in a model system? This was Anderson's idea. Then he wrote this famous paper on triangular lattice, and it was the field was essentially sleeping, except for a few papers from Japanese authors. Nobody was thinking about it. Then after a long gap came cuprates. Then Anderson quickly realized, particularly this paper played a very important role. In fact, these are all colleagues of Ram Sesha, who is here, Ganguly and Rao. They had done susceptibility measurement in lanthanum copper oxide, and their data was there, and Phil was actually at Bangalore in the famous valence fluctuation conference. He tells me that he saw their susceptibility data. There was no cusp. It was very smooth. So that gave him confidence to push his theory of RVB further. And then he said that these are all things that will be there in the system. I will come to it. So the idea was that, as opposed to a long-range antiferromagnetic ordered state, lanthanum copper oxide, particularly after a small amount of doping, like 1% of doping or 2% of doping, is well described by a liquid of these singlets which are running around, which are resonating. So it's a very novel idea. Immediately, Kivilson and Rokshar and Chetana jump in and said that if this be the case, the topology of the underlying bonds and their kind of hard core character, that is, you can't put two bonds on top of each other, allows for you to have an unpaired spin hanging around like this. So this will be natural topological excitations of an underlying bond liquid. So this is called a spin-on, and similarly, you can have an empty site that will be called a hole-on. So a whole lot of things came, and then in the process, they constructed, Kulson and Rokshar constructed a quantum dimer model, which began the idea of topological order that's very popular now. And Zhaogan, when took this RVB mean field solution that we'll discuss, and then introduced the notion of quantum order and so on. Very fascinating development. So this is a resonance already I have shown. Okay. Now the task that lay before us soon after Anderson's proposal was, okay, here is a spin liquid. How do you describe spin liquid mathematically? How do you calculate things? This is a very important thing. Because if you take any textbook on magnetism, quantum magnetism, what you find is spin wave theory, large 1/s expansion, where you assume some kind of ground state and then think it's a stable ground state and basically do stability analysis on a spin wave. As long as the spin wave frequencies are positive, you are happy. Whereas there was no way to describe a quantum spin liquid. So that is the stage in which I was there at in Anderson's group. So we faced this problem. Then we thought of the following. Since finally we are going to describe a liquid in which spins are running around with their moments, it is better to go back to the description of spins in terms of physical electrons that are constituting a spin. Like if I take hydrogen atom, there is a physical electron sitting there. It can spin, can be up or down. Now, so we don't write the spin operators in this language. Then we rewrote it in this particular form in terms of singlet operators. It's a simple exercise that you can take the super exchange Hamilton and rewrite it. Then that immediately suggested to you an approximation. This is something very interesting about mathematics. Often when you write it in a suggestive form, it already tells you what is the next step that you have to take. So this told us that if you have this form, you can, because this is something that we're used to doing Hartree-Fock decoupling. We do it, for example, in superconductivity theory, when you have four fermion terms, we decouple it like this, and then do a mean field theory. And that's what we did. And what we found was a very nice mean field solution. But in the process, we have done something wrong. While I can give this representation, I should keep in mind that in a hydrogen atom, in a Mott insulator, when the atoms are well separated, charge fluctuations are only virtual, they are not real. So that means there is a constraint that number of electron per site is 1. So I have lost this constraint in the process, so I keep that in mind, and we will come back to it. So I have introduced, in some sense, unphysical Hilbert space, so I may have to pay for it. And then let us look at the consequence of this analysis. The analysis was very interesting. We found out an effective Hamiltonian in which we started with Pauli spin operators. We end up with Bogoliubov quasi particles or fermions. And also, we calculate susceptibility of this. It looks exactly like what Ganguly and Rao got, Pauli-like susceptibility. So we were very excited. And now, then what is the thing that we have to do in order to correct it? Most important thing is this. That is, OK, you have enlarged the Hilbert space and done a mean field theory and then gotten a wave function. But then you have to go back and remove double occupancy. That's called Goodsuller projection. So this is something that we did approximately and then found out that it's reasonable. Recently, Tao Li and Vishwanathan company have actually analyzed this particular wave function, that is the Goodsuller projected mean field wave function that we have got very interesting, even long range order. This is something very, very, very fascinating and interesting. Even though you have a manifest spin liquid, once you Goodsuller project it, somehow the spin correlation is enhanced to the extent you have long range antiferromagnetic order. There are very nice consequences of that. I will not discuss it. So then we asked the question, we have enlarged the Hilbert space and done a theory. Is there anything that we can learn from what we knew before? For example, in gauge theory, enlargement of Hilbert space is very natural because finally, at the end of the day, we have to only calculate gauge invariant configurations. So there are notions like orbits, that is, there are many, many gauge fields which corresponds to the same physical state. So are we doing something along that line when we did this enlargement? The answer is yes. So this is what I will discuss. So we notice that in the mean field theory we did, or even in the Hamiltonian, suppose I take the fermion operator and then replace it by a phase factor which is site dependent, then the link variable transforms like this. Similarly, the mean field transforms like this, and then when you substitute it here, the mean field Hamiltonian as well as the full Hamiltonian remains invariant. So that means in this enlarged Hilbert space description, you have an U1 gauge invariance, which is a very simple fact that in a Martin insulator, the charge remains the same. While the spins fluctuate, charges do not move. Yes? Sorry? Ah, okay, I should have explained it. Yeah, delta ij, I had this. This is delta ij. Expectation value of this bond operator. That's delta ij. So, remember I was telling you at the beginning that I would like to have a theory where some kind of fermions appear and link fields, and this is the way it occurs in this particular mean field theory. Then now it is elevated to some kind of gauge theory. Now it is at this instant when Wilczek and Zee wrote a very nice paper. While we appreciated that this gauge field has something to do with spin, we could not put our hand. Then it was pointed out by Wen, Wilczek and Zee that if you take this combination of spins, in fact that is indeed related to the fields provided by this RVB condensate. I will discuss this in some detail later. Then also there was a very nice paper by Affleck, Anderson, and so on, so who pointed out if you look carefully, the symmetry is a little larger. I will not go into the details of that. So the idea is enlargement of Hilbert space and mean field theory gives link variable, and then depending on what kind of model you have, you can have a Z2 gauge theory description, U1 gauge theory description, and SU2 gauge theory description. So these are all like different possible phases. Many of these things are very nicely summarized in Zaugan Wen's book on many body theory and also in his papers. Now, one of the offshoots of this mean field theory and gauge theory, emerging gauge theory, was topological order in the spin liquids became an important issue. And then the underlying Chern-Simons type of theory also became, and then quantum number fractions, which was already there. And this is a very important thing, existence of a pseudo Fermi surface. So many of these things which you don't anticipate, because if you think of a magnet, you think of boson, collective modes. Here you have quantum number fractionization, you get gauge fields, and you get chirality and many variety of things. So now I will spend some time, about maybe 10 minutes, discussing Kitaev model, because it's such a beautiful and friendly model. Very often solvable models are very unfriendly. Like if you look at Bethe-Ansatz, it's a lot of algebra and lots of things are there, but here it's very, very friendly. And basically Kitaev used the tricks that we used, but he invented a Hamiltonian for which the trick that we used becomes exact. So in that sense, its value immediately goes up. So Kitaev took a honeycomb lattice and he put spins on the vertices and then said that if I take a site, for example, 2, I have a neighbor who is going down, so I will call this as Y bond. I will call this as a X bond and the vertical one as a Z bond. So there are 3 bonds to every site. And he said, if I look at the X bond, the spins at the end of the bonds will have only X component in the interaction. And the spins at the Y bond will have Y component. They will have Z component. So if you look at the Hamiltonian, piecewise it looks like an Ising model, looks trivial. But on the other hand, the sum is not trivial because they don't commute. So you have a genuine quantum model in which term by term they don't commute. And Kitaev solved this model exactly. And then it turns out to be one of the best spin liquid from many points of view. Now Kitaev also observed that, by the way he has constructed the model, there are operators like this called the flux operator. That is, for example, you take this hexagon and then take the spins from each side, and then if you take site 1 for this loop, you look at the normal component, namely that is going out, so that will be sigma y, and then sigma 2 z, and then sigma 3 x, and so on. And then he showed that you can check very easily that this operator for every Plaquet commutes with the full Hamiltonian. Very nice to see that. And also they commute among themselves. So already you have several commuting objects, but of course it doesn't solve the problem completely because they are only half of the total number of degrees of freedom. So you are left with something else. And further, if you take the square of this, it's one. That means you can characterize eigenstates of this full Hamiltonian in terms of eigenvalues of this BP corresponding to every Plaquet. Okay. So in other words, even the existence of this commuting object tells you your Hilbert space decomposes into 2 to the power of n states, where 2n is the number of sites. And then in each state, there is a unique configuration of BP. For example, in this box, all the BP will be plus 1. In the next box, one of the BP will be minus 1, and so on. So this is a model I want to solve it. Now, if you stare at it, it looks very hard. How can one solve it? Then Ketayev used this following trick. In our case, we went to the original fermion variables in terms of spin. Instead, what Ketayev did was he introduced lattice-Majorana fermion, which was already there in Kondo problem and many other contexts. He said that if you take a lattice fermion, you can write it as real and imaginary part. And then if you check the commutation relations, the anti-commute and the squares is 1. Now he said, I will introduce 4 Majorana fermion, characterized by an index alpha equal to 0, x, y, z. It's like a time component and 3 space components, and they have this commutation relation. Now, we also had 4 Majorana fermions because we have 2 complex fermions, upspin electron and downspin electron. So in fact, you can make a one-to-one correspondence between this and our construction. But however, the way Ketayev constructed his Hamiltonian, there was the whole thing yielded to a very nice description. Then the dimension of the Hilbert space now, what is physical Hilbert space is 2 to the power of 2n because 2n is the number of lattice sites. Now I have enlarged the dimension of Hilbert space because I have 4 Majorana fermion. In a manner of speaking, if a complex fermion is made up of 2 Majorana fermion, it is as if the Hilbert space of each Majorana fermion is square root of 2. In fact, you may wonder, is it physical? The answer is yes. In fact, there is a famous two-channel Kondo problem where you have a metal containing 2 identical Fermi surfaces, put a magnetic impurity. This impurity couples through exchange interaction with the conduction electrons. At the end of the day, it traps one component of fermion, namely it traps a Majorana fermion, and the real part is staying here and the imaginary part goes to the boundary. So it's remarkable. So when you calculate specific heat and entropy, local entropy from the exact solution, you get half log 2. So the Hilbert space fractionalization is indeed real. The total system is happy and it has an integer dimensional Hilbert space, but locally things behave as if you have a fractional Hilbert space. So now if you take this construct and then you can show that they obey this spin commutation relation, and also you notice that there is this operator. This has eigenvalue plus 1 or minus 1. So you stick to the subspace in which it is plus 1. That means that's like Goodsuller projection. So we had a local constraint that Na up plus Na down equal to 1. Here you have another constraint, which is another way of writing it. This is equal to plus 1 or minus 1. So you choose to be in plus 1. This is that. Now what is remarkable is when Ketayev made this and then substituted, some miracle happens. So what you have is you have, as expected, a spin operator, S dot S, which contains 4 Majorana fermion, C, and then this U, which is a combination of C. But it so happened, because of the way the Hamiltonian is constructed, this operator commutes with the Hamiltonian. So that's very nice, because originally in our RVB theory, what did we do? We gave an expectation value to this by hand, like a Hartree-Fock factorization. Here, he need not give an expectation value. Since it commutes with the Hamiltonian, we can choose one of its eigenvalues, namely plus or minus 1, because this U operator, if you square it, it's 1. So that's a very remarkable thing. Just by construction, his Hamiltonian has 2 fermion term, but one piece reduces to a classical variable. then at the end, then it's very simple. Okay, now. Then what I'm left with is, I'm left with a bilinear problem. That is, Majorana fermions hopping from site I to site J to I with numbers which corresponds to various gauge copies. I will come to that. So he solved the problem in one shot. And of course, corresponding to each BP configuration. Now, there is a lesson here. It's something very interesting. It normally doesn't happen. I started with a problem in which I had 2 to the power of 2n physical Hilbert space. So I enlarged the Hilbert space. So, and there are 2 to the power of 2n such copies. And what has happened is, all these pockets, all these boxes are basically gauge copies of the original Hilbert space. That's remarkable. That means I don't need to worry about projection. So I can sit in one of the gauge copies, or I can choose a particular gauge, and then calculate gauge invariant objects, and they will remain the same wherever I am. So this is a luxury that we did not have in our mean field theory and gauge theory. Here, the way he has constructed the Hamiltonian, the enlargement of Hilbert space essentially introduces gauge copies. So the spectrum of the problem, the many body spectrum, remains identical in each gauge copy. So I don't need to do Goodsmuller projection. If I want to calculate actual wave function, then I'll have to do that. But as long as I'm interested in eigenvalues and correlation functions, things fall in place and everything is given exactly. So this was Kitaev's achievement. And it's a remarkable, since I mentioned about frustration, let me mention a little bit about it. This is the most frustrated system you can imagine. It's not geometrically frustrated. However, there's frustration in spin space. If you take, for example, spin 2, its neighbor, site number 3, tells him that you please point along y direction. This fellow tells that you please point along x direction. This fellow tells me that you please point along the z direction. So he gets 3 competing messages from 3 neighbors, so he's totally frustrated. So the end result is something remarkable. This is the work that Saptarshi Mandal, Shankar, and myself in our institute did. We calculated the spin-spin correlation function, which Kitaev did not do. And we were able to do it exactly. We got a very surprising result. The spin-spin correlation function vanishes identically beyond nearest neighbor. So that means it's the best spin liquid you can imagine, short of an independent collection of spins. So nearest neighbor correlation is non-vanishing. Next nearest neighbor and beyond is identically zero. However, it supports gapless excitation. This is something. So now, this is what I said. So I choose this BP Plaquet values, and then I have just a free Majorana fermion moving on a honeycomb lattice. You can do a Bogoliubov transformation, and you will get a problem which is exact like graphene. And then this is what you get. So this is your Brillouin zone. There are 2 points, K and K prime, and you get 2 Dirac cones. So this is a so-called zero flux sector. So only particle-like fermionic excitation are present. And they are gapless. This is strange, because one of the folklores propagated by Laughlin was that if you want to have a spin liquid, and if it is short range, your excitations have to be gap. For example, that's what happened in his chiral spin liquid, which we will discuss a little later. Whereas here is a situation in which you have gapless excitations propagating, but however, spin-spin correlation functions is decaying faster than exponential. So what all it means is something very nice. While the underlying spin variables are there, are responsible for whatever is happening, they do not propagate much further. What propagates are some very collective extended objects, like vertices, and they have their free and low energy life. So there's an extreme decoupling. Now, in other words, if I take this fermionic excitation, which is a physical excitation, and want to express it in terms of spin variable, it's extremely non-local and it involves essentially all spins in the system. So something like that is happening in a resonating valence bond state also. While spins constitute the basic degree of freedom, but they form singlets and they resonate, and what emerges is something very different, which is distantly related to underlying spin. Here, the relation between the underlying spin and Majorana fermion is essentially lost, because they don't propagate much further. So this is the nice message from Kitaev model, which shows that some of the concepts produced by RVB theory are indeed correct in this particular case. And there are other fascinating things, like you can solve this Kitaev model in terms of these three parameters, you have gapless space, and also you can create localized zero energy Majorana fermion and do topological quantum computation. I will not go into that. I will now come to the one of the main message of this talk. Now, so we see that fermions are there. How much time do I have? 15 minutes, okay. So is it possible to have, like when we think about electrodynamics or gauge theory, the vacuum is Lorentz invariant. So there are no expectation values of magnetic or electric fields. Now, once you have a condensed matter systems like this, there is nothing which is preventing us from violating Lorentz invariant. We violate translation invariance, we violate rotation invariance, so we violate all possible things. So what about violating Lorentz invariance kind of thing? And is it possible to have this non-zero expectation values of this chirality operator in the ground state? In other words, if I take like a big loop, Wilson loop, A dot dl, I will have some area times some pseudo-magnetic field. So in other words, interaction among emergent gauge fields, can they favor presence of finite magnetic field in the ground state? This will be very interesting. And in fact, this is indeed related to the proposal of Laughlin. So now let me briefly point out the when we'll check this very important work. So we introduced this link field as an approximation, and then they can be rewritten two different ways without violating anything. And then, so these are all like Wilson loops. That is, you take a triangle, take tau 1, 2, tau 2, 3, tau 3, 1, and then take the complex conjugate, and then it's like exponential of this Berry phase or Baumhofer phase. So this is the way it is related to the fermion variable. So we would like to see if this RVB gauge flux can condense in the ground state. Now, since we are dealing with the spin problem, there is another analogy which is very, very useful in thinking about this problem. This helped Laughlin, and it has helped many people. In fact, when we remember in last week's four-corner, there were talks on spin liquids in Bose-Hubbard model by Roger and others, and this is related to this. So the Hilbert space of spin half is very small, so you have either up or down spin. So let me make a correspondence of this with a harmonic oscillator, zero ground state, first excitation, and so on. Then let me remove this by hand and make a correspondence between up spin with vacuum of an oscillator and down spin with the first excited state of the oscillator. And I will say for some reason, these things have gone up in energy. I have modified Hamiltonian, my Hamiltonian, and pushed up it in energy. So you can rewrite the spin Hamiltonian in terms of kinetic and potential energy. So what you find is the S plus S minus 1 term becomes a very nice hopping term. And then the SZSZ becomes a two-body interaction term. In this case, it's repulsive. And then a chemical potential term. So a chemical potential term, which prefers half the spins up on half the spin down, or a paramagnetic state, which means in terms of hardcore bosons, it should be a half-filled band of hardcore bosons. So this is a very nice analogy. In fact, Laughlin used it in a very effective way. So let me also say that the position of these hardcore bosons, when I discuss in terms of wave functions, will be denoted by a coordinate z, a complex number x plus I, y in the plane. Now let me do this problem in the language of boson. And what is interesting is, if we go back to the antiferromagnetic Heisenberg Hamiltonian, it's J, which is positive. So that means a hopping matrix element has a sign such that if you do a band theory, if you solve the spectrum, the band is inverted. Normally, if you do a standard tight binding model, what you will get is you'll have a minimum at the gamma point, and then the energy will go up. In this case, because it's antiferromagnetic coupling, it's maximum at the gamma point, and then minimum at the M point. Now, if you look at the M point in the Brillouin zone for this triangular lattice, what you find is you set three sets of points. This is one set, this is another set. So there are 3 points, M1, M2, and M3, in which the dispersion has minimum. Now, what will bosons do? Bosons in their ground state will go to the minimum and condense. Now, the bosons have a problem. There are 3 minima. Where will I condense? Can I condense in M1 or M2, M3 or some linear combination? So at the end, and also all this has to be done in the presence of hot core and nearest neighbor repulsion. At the end, what happens is these bosons choose to condense in these 3 sublattices separately. In other words, each site will have half boson and running around. But they would like to have a relative phase, or you can say absolute phase, theta m1 equal to 0, theta 2 equal to 2 pi by 3, and theta 3 equal to 4 pi by 3. So in the magnetism language, it means the spins have a planar ordering in which sublattice A is up, and this is 120 degree and 240 degree. So this is what happens in, if you take a hardcore boson and do some approximate analysis, so there is a Bose condensation like this. Now, yeah. Exactly. So that is coming because of this peculiar relation between this coefficient and this. So if I look at it, it looks as if this problem only has a U1 global invariance. Because this looks like a kinetic energy term, it preserves a number. But you notice that there is a specific coefficient, is 1 here and half here. In general, if I have an XY anisotropy, a rising anisotropy, there will be a lambda as I indicated before. Sorry? First, exactly. No, in the case space, they have 3 minima. Yes. Exactly. If I solve the nearest neighbor hopping, 3. No, no. See, I'm doing a quantum problem. I'm doing boson hopping on this honeycomb lattice, on the triangular lattice, and with wrong sign for hopping. So the band is inverted. And then you have a maximum at the gamma point and 2 minimum. Now, when you do the same thing on a honeycomb lattice, you will get these 2 degenerate points corresponding to k and k prime. It's on a honeycomb lattice. Yeah, this is a triangular lattice. You're solving the triangular lattice problem. Sorry if I have made a, yeah. I'm talking about triangular lattice. For a honeycomb, it's different. Yeah, we can talk about it. This is very important that this choice of separation into Z and Y for an SU2 rotation, it's only convenient. So that means there is an additional symmetry which actually reduces the number of Goldstone modes. Correct. Yes, it's 120 degree, which is the ground state. Oh, the chiral, okay. Sure. Very important point. Yeah, what Sang-Sik is pointing out is that, so I have this 3 states. So that means if I go clockwise, my spin is also rotating clockwise. There is another state in which if I go clockwise, my spin is rotating like this, but how do I draw the next one? So these 2 are distinct. So that means in this particular case, the relative phases will have the opposite value.
What is the other ground state? So you said there are three minimum.
So here I condense them with, so to be strict, I should talk about relative phases. So theta 1 minus theta 2, theta 2 minus theta 3, theta 3 minus. So these fellows follow this way or this way. So they are the 2 equivalent, inequivalent ground states. In fact, I can form many other ground states also. The phases of the condensate. So I talk about Bose condensation in sublattice A, sublattice B, and sublattice C. And then I choose the relative phases. Exactly, the overall phase is not meaningful. So these are right descriptions, theta 1 minus theta 2. Exactly, yeah. Exactly, they are the two famous sets of degenerate states in which I have positive chirality or negative chirality, planar chirality. Yeah, this is important that if I look at XY model, classical XY model in a triangular lattice, antiferromagnetic couple, in addition to global rotation, I have a discrete symmetry related two states. You cannot continuously go from here to here. That is a point that's being made. Yes, that is still here. Okay, let me proceed quickly. Now, while analyzing this triangular lattice, you can see, Anderson gave this idea that Pauling's RVB will be very helpful for here, and he got some energy. And then, in fact, Laughlin, as soon as this RVB theory came, he inspired by some remarks, in fact, he acknowledges right at the beginning by Denghai Li and Yiannopoulos, that there is a deep connection between this state and quantum Hall effect. So Laughlin was very quick to find out this beautiful wave function, which is written in the hardcore boson language. Here, Z corresponds to the position of the downspin or the hardcore particle on this triangular lattice. So you may, will recognize this as a quantum Hall wave function, except for this important extra factor. So there is a nice, interesting history. In November 1987, we had a small RVB meeting at Princeton. And Bob Laughlin had just finished this work and presented it in our meeting. Then at the end of his talk, I went and made a comment saying that this wave function is intrinsically complex, so it indicates some time reversal symmetry breaking state. So Laughlin jumped and said, no, it's not true. This important phase factor is there. Finally, it will make this whole thing real. And this is basically the same as Laughlin Anderson's wave function, which is time reversal symmetric. So this was Laughlin's remark. In fact, he makes this remark in his paper also. But of course, very quickly, soon Zhao Gang showed explicitly that indeed this wave function breaks parity and time reversal. It's a state with non-zero chirality that we discussed. Anyway, so in fact, people have found out some Hamiltonian for which it's a ground state wave function. That's a very complicated Hamiltonian involving this chirality operator. But the important message is that resonating valence bonds have some connection to strongly correlated fractional quantum Hall states. Like this in the language of quantum Hall will correspond to m equal to 2 or half filled Landau level, nu equal to half. Not the, in, for electrons, you need to have odd number. Here, for bosons, you have an even number. So this began a whole set of investigation connection to Chern-Simons theory, that is connection of RVB state to Chern-Simons theory and so on. I will not go into this. So this is a state in which things condense. So now, next thing is, okay, there are, one can give mean field. So what I did at that time was, this is, I'm going to finish in 5 minutes. Is there 5 minutes? Then Vilcek in their paper introduced a very nice identity that you can write the sum of squares of three neighboring spins in terms of this chirality square. It's a very beautiful, because it is true because you have Pauli spin operator. It is not true if you have spin one or spin two operator. So this enabled me to write down standard triangular lattice Hamiltonian in this form. And then it allowed me to do an analysis, I will not go into the details, to extract an effective theory in which this chirality appears as a scalar variable. And what I found was that if you start with a J1, J2 model, in general you have a term which looks like a gauge, local gauge theory, and then the non-neighbor interaction, namely alpha, non-zero value of alpha, introduces some thing which restores local, which removes local symmetry and makes it into a global symmetry. So what you have is some effective Hamiltonian like this. Again, I will not go into the detail, but the interesting thing is it gave me a phase diagram in which the standard system that analyzed by Anderson and Laughlin will not, is unlikely to break chiral symmetry in my approximate analysis, but introduce some further frustration. You may go to into a state in which you have this chiral magnetic field present in the ground state in every plaquette with the same sign or in an antiferromagnetic way. So this is called antiferromagnetic chirality or ferromagnetic chirality. So interestingly, this suggestion has been there, but nobody has analyzed it. So what people did was analyze this paper. That is, they take this model in which you have a square lattice with an nearest and next nearest neighbor coupling. And then in response to a comment by my friend Pierce Coleman, I pointed out that if I extend my work to square lattice, what you get is you get a staggered chirality. In other words, these three spins in this elementary square, they have minus, plus, minus, plus. So overall, you always get antiferromagnetic chirality. And so far, no analysis exists in which people have looked at antiferromagnetic chiral susceptibility. People always, at least two papers, they measure ferromagnetic susceptibility, chiral susceptibility, and say that it's suppressed. But according to my old investigation, it should be antiferromagnetic susceptibility. So what I believe is, if we come back to this recent work, in which it has been done extensively, for example, by Leon Balance, so they go to J1, J2 model. They find a window of now new opportunity, namely spin liquid, because originally people said that perhaps there is a valence bond solid phase like this. Now still, you know, there is a debate, but there are good indication that it is a spin liquid. Now if you look at their analysis as well as the tensor network analysis, they have essentially forced themselves to non-chiral states. So recently I have suggested that it is good to make the tensors complex, and then you may find islands here where indeed you have a chiral spin liquid. And that makes this very interesting. So these are all the recent work by Wen's group, and this paper by Wu and Kao, and also Richter. And of course, now there's a lot of interesting possibilities. Suppose there is a chiral order, which is a spontaneous symmetry breaking, but also at the same time, it's like a quantum Hall-like state. Then it supports this conventional long-range order as well as topological order. So questions that are recently investigated by Melko and company needs to be investigated in this case in which you have a chiral order as well as topological order. And does it make sense in this context? So there are many interesting questions. And now there are other lattices, honeycomb lattice and Kagome, where many of these things are being investigated. Very interesting things are there. And what you find is, for both lattices, there is a special choice of J2 and J1 in which you can write the Hamiltonian in this language. So one can say with some confidence that at that point, chiral symmetry is not broken. But if you move away from it, there is a possibility that you get a chiral spin liquid. Thank you very much. Exactly. So it's
so breaking translations.
No, within the sorry. Yeah. You need not break trans. For example, here, the choice of the link variables is that's like a gate choice that may break, make it into square root 2 by square root 2 lattice. But within a flux, for example, according to this, you can have a minus, minus, plus, plus, and the same thing getting repeated. So you can have two kinds of possibility, in which is the square root 2 by square root of chiral order. Exactly, enlarge. Even without enlarging, there are two things possible.
It's like a flux within a unit cell.
Flux within, exactly, within like a unit cell. There are, there are these four triangles. There can be. It is very much like Haldane's suggestion for topological, in which to realize parity anomaly, he suggested some hopping configuration in which translation symmetry is maintained.
It breaks only time
reverse. Only time reverse, exactly, in the same.
Is there any real system which kind of follows the Kitaev model?
That's a very good question. There is a sodium iridate compound, which there is two schools of thought. Kaliulin and Jackeli, they have done some detailed analysis. They think it's very close to Kitaev model. There are other groups which say that the departure is very strong.
But so, what is it that actually makes this so anisotropic system? That along one direction, you have only x direction of the
so system. That is the solid state chemistry. You know, what happens is in iridate, you have this 5D orbitals with a lot of spin orbit coupling. One of the manifolds corresponding to x, y, y, z, z, x, they have the right direction, and I don't know the details, but it, at least according to one analysis, beautifully follows. It looks like a nature-given compound. But there are other suggestions that you can construct Josephson circuits in which this kind of anisotropic spin coupling is simulated. And also there are suggestions that you could have it in cold atoms. But as far as real material is concerned, this is the only thing that I know. But there are also, you know, the Kitaev model has a history. Kugel and Komsky wrote down a model, in fact, on a simpler lattice. On a square lattice, they wrote down a model which is very similar to Kitaev model. But unfortunately, there is no exact solution. So the model did not become popular. Whereas in a honeycomb lattice, it's exactly solved. So there are realizations of square lattice Kitaev model. And there are some analysis which indicates that some of these physics will survive there also. Approximate analysis.
So it's basically a two-dimensional honeycomb lattice.
Exactly. That's what you put for a nice realization of Kitaev model. But it is, at the end, what is important to realize Kitaev physics is you need a lattice in which your connectivity is 3. You have coupled to 3 neighbors. So Saptarshi Mandal and Naveen from our institute, they constructed a three-dimensional model, fully three-dimensional, where they can solve it exactly. Because there the connectivity in that model is 3. And they have some very beautiful Majorana-Fermion structures and so on.
More questions?
Thank you.